Music from Bradley Soash at the piano. And there is A Balm in Gilead. From Fernando Ortega, we're heard on the line from Sarah Groves. Love is still a worthy cause. And good morning to you. 14 minutes past the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and of course that means none other than the Reverend Dr. John DeLancey joining us this morning from Glenshaw, Pennsylvania. John, good morning to you.
Good morning, guys. It's good to be with you.
And I think we were kind of wrestling with our technical connections here. David, come in, David. David Allen Punt.
Oh, here I am.
David,
yes.
Is there. Okay.
I'm here. Yes, I am.
Got the whole team on board then.
I'm slightly distracted here.
You're
I'm listening
two,
to story.
Two pairs of headphones, I see.
I got a couple of extra pair of headphones.
Yes.
I'm watching a story about a woman who is having a battle with her ex-husband in Rhode Island. And the woman taught her bird how to scream curses at the husband's new girlfriend.
Oh, well, yeah. That sounds like a convoluted mess to me.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
So the woman was fined for $15 for noise pollution.
Uh-huh.
And she's fighting it.
Well, it's not a Pennsylvania resident, is it?
No.
Okay, I thought we could send John out to give him a hand, straighten that mess out.
Do you have your picture up, John? Am I missing your picture?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay. Well, yeah.
I'm digressing a little bit.
Well, you are there. There he comes.
Okay. There's the beginning of the picture.
There he is.
Okay. There you are.
John, looking to be in fine fettle today. You sent me an article about a brand new find in Jerusalem, which is really intriguing. I'm sitting here looking at the website. By the way, we will be talking about Hatzor, in a few minutes. And there's a link to a Hatzor video on our Broken Road Radio website. If you look at the top of the homepage, toward the top, there's a link you can copy into your browser and see a video of Hatzor if you want to do that ahead of time. But for the moment, we're going to talk about a brand new cistern. A cistern stores water. And I think of them as barrels, like rain barrels. But in Jerusalem, it was a whole different thing. Tell us about cisterns in Jerusalem, John.
Well, this is an exciting, almost accidental find. The last number of trips I've gone on, we've walked up what is called a drainage channel, if you will, from the Pool of Siloam mentioned in John 9 all the way up to the southwestern corner of the Temple Mount called Robinson's Arch. Well, accidentally, Eli Shukran, it was just recently published, they found a first temple or Old Testament cistern right in that very general area just south and west of the Temple Mount, first one of its kind, and this particular cistern once held 250 cubic meters of water, or the equivalent of 66,000 gallons of water.
My goodness.
Wow.
And this really changes the whole theory that the Gihon Spring, which is located on the eastern slope of the city of David, was the only water source for not only David, but also even in Second Temple times. This really blows that theory almost out of, no pun intended, water, because it's perhaps perceived that this cistern played a very important role not only in the public life of Israelites, even in the First Temple period, which is, of course, the time of the Old Testament, but perhaps this also played a very important role in the use of water, in the purification, in the mikvahs, in the ritual baths. There are about 60 or 70 of them on the southern end of the Temple Mount as you would enter into the temple, but also perhaps this reservoir water was used in other water libation festivals dealing or that went on the Temple Mount itself. So this is unbelievable.
So this dates back to 800-900 BC or BCE.
Most likely 3,000 years old, to about the time of Solomon. So indeed, when Solomon built his temple, no doubt this cistern perhaps was even also built at the same time.
Are these hand are they carved out? But this is underground. It's rock. I'm looking at a photo here, and it looks to be, I'll bet it's 60 feet long, and maybe 12, 15 feet wide, and probably 18 feet deep. is what it looks like. Unless I'm, this is deep underground. Is this just under the surface? How is this?
This is actually under the surface. Must have been, and I don't know exactly where it's located in proximity to this drainage channel that you can walk up, which is actually Herodian, but almost by mistake they found this. It was no doubt dug out, but then also plastered because of soft limestone, of course, is very soft as it would not hold water. So it was plastered in a way that you know, we see a similar system, a cistern in Beersheba, for instance.
This looks like smooth walls but irregular in shape, but we're saying that people back in that time went underground and dug this out, created the cistern. It's not a naturally occurring cave, for example.
Right, and then they plastered it so it could hold water without it absorbing, you know, into the limestone itself.
Would it have been useful? Did they access the water from up above through a well opening?
Yeah, something like that.
Or pools?
I'm not sure exactly the details here, but no doubt they would have been able to throw a bucket down or something into the cistern. But, of course, it would have to have been kept dark and concealed, or else the water would be contaminated or start growing, you know, algae and so forth. But like all other cisterns in Israel, this is just a spectacular find. And, again, it's going to revolutionize the whole theory of the use of water and the source of water, no doubt in Jerusalem, because obviously the cistern was used to contain runoff water from this middle or central valley called the Tyropian Valley. So it was used to contain any kind of, you know, rain runoff water possible, especially how important that is in proximity or in relationship to the weather in Israel, because, you know, there's 6, 7, 8 months of where there's no rain at all. So
that's what I was going to ask, because I know Jerusalem is at altitude. Is it about 2,500 feet, something like that?
Yeah, and they get a lot of rain, almost as much rain as London, but it only comes within 2 or 2.5 months, primarily, with the exceptions of showers here and there in maybe November and December. But January and February are really the rainy months, and to contain water like this in a cistern like this is just amazing.
Well, if you'd like to see the photos, it's over at jspace.com. And I'm wondering if I can get a link up here on the website a little bit later, but that's a stunning photograph of this thing. And apparently really changed some minds, reversed some earlier assumptions about life in Jerusalem during the time of the first temple. It goes way, way back. Also going way, way back is a place called Hatzor, which is in northern Israel. That's in the tribal territory of Dan, isn't it, John?
Yeah, it's about 10 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. And Hatzor was one of the three of the 31 cities that Joshua conquered, as mentioned in the Joshua text. Hatzor, Ai or Ai, and Jericho were the three cities that are recorded to have been burned or destroyed in with fire by Joshua and the conquering Israelites.
Of course, we talked last week about Jericho and discovery there of brick walls that had fallen down, and apparently some evidence of fire that it happened. Is similar evidence available to Hatzor?
Yes, and again, it all depends on how one interprets the finds there. There is certainly a burn level. Yigal Yadin was actually the one who excavated this site in from 1955 to about 1958, and then he reopened the excavation in 1968. So Hatzor actually is one of the largest, if not the largest, site. It's consists of two tiers, if you will. There's an upper part of this large Canaanite city that's about 30 acres, and that's the area where the excavation has taken place, and it actually is still going on this year. But the lower city is about 170 acres. So this whole tell, if you will, and this ancient mound is over 200 acres large. So it's the largest site in Israel. And what's so amazing about it is there are 18 occupational levels represented here, starting in about the middle part of the Middle Bronze Period, which would be about the 18th century, all the way down to the 2nd century B.C.
My goodness. So it's been inhabited for a long time, as was Jericho, although Jericho goes back unless you're a young earther, the science community now says it goes back 10, 11,000 BC. Hazor equally as old?
Not that old. It goes back, again, like I mentioned, just to the Middle Bronze period, but certainly in this Canaanite period where it's theorized that 30 or 40,000 people lived here, not necessarily within this city, but we do know that when Joshua comes on the scene, and we talked about the date of Joshua's conquest being the 15th century or about 1400 BC versus an earlier date of 1200 BC or 1250, there is a burn level here. However, when Yigal-Yadin came and excavated at this site, he did observe the burn level, but he did not even think of attributing it to Joshua, because he dates it to the 13th century.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but the tribe of Dan had trouble conquering its assigned territory, which was originally south of there, closer to Judah and, and to Benjamin. And gradually they kind of wandered up north for something easier to conquer, I guess. Did they succeed in conquering that area? Did that become, the Bible? Does the Bible? I don't remember the Bible telling us about Hazor and the outcome of the battle, but that could be just my ignorance. Is it covered?
Well, it's covered in the Bible in Joshua chapter 11, but not in the context of the tribe of Dan. These people from just west of Jerusalem, the tribe of Dan, actually moved north at a later period and defeated a city called Laish. It's called Dan today, but that's actually further north of Hazor today. You can see the excavations of even a Middle Bronze gate there that perhaps even Abraham went through. It's mentioned in, I think, Genesis chapter 14. But getting back to Hazor.
Dan had trouble with the Philistines, so they moved up north and picked on a different people, basically, is what happened. And were successful there. Now, those were Canaanites, and weren't they precursors of the Philistines? Or is there a connection between them?
There's no connection there. The Philistines were certainly people from the west, whether that be a Mycenaean civilization or culture that moved. And they were only, essentially, only in one area of Israel, and that would be the Philistine plain. There's five cities of the Philistines. So
right along the coast there, then.
Along the coast there, and they only sort of show up for about 200 years, and then they sort of disappear at a time when David defeated them. But the Canaanites, of course, were here before the Israelites came. And so when we take a look at the excavation here, we do know that, according to, I think it's Judges chapter 4, in the context of Deborah and Barak, they actually defeat these people, these Canaanites, and it very well could be that there are two levels of destruction here. One attributed to the time of the judges, which is, of course, post-Joshua. And then the other, this strata 3, as it's called. Indeed, it's very possible to interpret this as being the part of the city that was destroyed by Joshua. Obviously, and perhaps apparently, after the city was destroyed by Joshua, it seems likely that the Canaanites were able to rebuild or reestablish Hazor, and then later on, in another 200 or 300 years, it was destroyed again, like I said, and that story is mentioned in Judges chapter 4.
Okay, so Dan fought and lost and then won again? I'm confused about how the tribe of Dan eventually settled there. So Joshua would have taken the city, and then it went back to the Canaanites. They could not occupy the land, apparently.
That's correct, yeah. And it was during the time of the judges that apparently Hazor was reestablished by the Canaanites and then again destroyed once more. So when we look at the archaeological evidence, we just can't dismiss that there was just a 13th century burn level associated with the judges, but indeed there is a very clear biblical chronology that places Joshua's conquest you know, more closer to the 1400 date, and it does sound, and some of the destruction levels indeed can be dated to that time period. Even Yadin suggests that the Canaanites lived there from the 15th through the 13th century. So within the realm of possibility, it certainly can be concluded that Hazor was defeated twice, once by Joshua in the 15th century, and then later on by Deborah and Barak and the Israelites during the time of the judges in the 13th century.
Now, we're talking about Hazor, which is in the north of Israel, and on the Broken Road Radio homepage on the website there, up toward the left top, there's a little mention of John Delancey, who joins us every Monday, and at the bottom of that paragraph is a link to a YouTube video, which is like a three-dimensional aerial view of Hazor. And you can click on that. Well, it's not a link in the article, so copy it and paste it into your browsers, and it'll be an interesting quick tour of Hazor there. Very interesting. John, what is there about the Hazor location that makes it so inhabitable? Why is it such a key location?
It's a key location because the Via Maris, which actually starts down in Egypt and comes up the coastal plain and then juts a little east through the Jezreel Valley, and that's why Megiddo is the primary city of importance there. It sort of controls that whole route. Well, when we end up following this natural route, if you will, of this road called the Via Maris, it actually, when it gets north of the Sea of Galilee, it cuts right through this Hula Valley. And that's exactly where Hazor is located. So Hazor actually controlled the northern part of the kingdom of...
So this is where the Babylonians and the Assyrians would have funneled down into Israel?
It indeed was. Every conquering army from the north would have come through this area, the Hula Valley, past Hazor, and certainly that's why the Canaanites established this city there, and that's why it was so important for Joshua to conquer it as well, so that he himself could control this northern route into the land of Israel. And again, archaeology seems to indicate the truth of, again, the biblical narrative. Mm-hmm.
Is it inhabited today? Is it a modern city, or is it simply an archaeological site now?
Hazor is just an archaeological site. It's actually... They actually have a new road that sort of bypasses now Hazor. The old road used to go right past it, so you could actually, and you can still see somewhat part of the tell because it's so large, but you actually have to get off the four-lane highway and get on the two-lane and visit Hazor that way, but still very prominently seen, and still you can understand and appreciate how it was used as a very strategic strategically located city, both in the Canaanite period as well as in the Israelite period.
I'm guessing it's on your tour, on your itinerary for your upcoming... Is it the next tour? You'll be stopping at Hazor?
Yeah, we typically
in November.
Mm-hmm. Hazor and Megiddo are similar sites because they have so many levels of occupation. But Hazor, just like Megiddo, has a water source. They have very impressive Canaanite mud brick walls that we actually can... understand played a role in the Jericho story. We have a very significant high place that the Canaanites use
worship
for
spot, yeah.
Worship. Mm-hmm. And again, maybe that's one reason why Joshua was so determined to, and really commanded to, destroy this city by fire, because it was a primary cultic center, if you will, of the Canaanites.
It's interesting that God commanded him in each case, in Jericho and in Hazor, to destroy it by fire, to burn it down, completely obliterate it, mm-hmm. but using fire rather than possess it and use it for your own people. I mean, that's there's something significant there, and I won't claim to fully understand it. But it's interesting that it was common to both those sites. We're talking with the Reverend Dr. John Delancey. John is a pastor in Glenshaw, Pennsylvania, and an archaeology student, but he brings us a lot of expertise, and he's been to Israel many times. He leads Biblical Israel Tours. He has a website that tells you more about that. One's coming up in November, and I think you're lining up some spring tours already, aren't you, for next year?
Yeah, I have about six or seven tours actually planned next year, from April, May, June, and July, and then a few in the fall. So
very exciting,
very unique tours. And yeah, I'm excited about expanding my ministry to Israel next year. And I invite any of your listeners to consider joining me.
Now, I bet you'll be putting that new cistern high on your list. I wonder if you'd be able to visit that, actually.
I'm actually curious to see if that will be open yet, but we'll see. But I'll let you know after the November trip.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. You can link to John's website from ours. It's over on the right-hand side of our website. BiblicalIsraelTours.com is the site. And I'm presuming you're listening on BrokenRoadRadio.com. If not, you might want to switch over there, and you can listen from that site, from our site, and join in the chat and participate in all the links. We've got some useful things for you, including audio archives, recordings of each of our conversations with John and others, available in our audio archives. You can get them as podcasts, too. You can actually download them. David, you look very thoughtful there. Do you have a question?
Well, I'm glad you came back to the cistern. I'm wondering, does... do we have a good idea of where the knowledge came from to design the cistern and then to put plaster on the inside to make sure it held water? I mean, is that old technology? Is that an old knowledge, or is that something inventive?
Well, we have other cisterns that date to that time period in Israel. Beersheba, I think Arad has some cisterns. So I don't know where that technology or the expertise came, but certainly I would think just simply learning how to survive with the minimum amount of water, I would think that the idea surfaced to be able to contain the water. We see it, Arad and Hatzor, Beersheba, for instance, how the cities were actually built in a round structure with rounded curves and with streets that allowed the water to drain into these cisterns. So I guess just common sense concluded that if you could contain the water somehow, that would be just a plus for the city. So I'm not exactly sure when that technology developed, but just makes perfect common sense to be able to do that.
You know, we do have some clues about the Israeli skill as plasterers. Apparently that was and to my knowledge, is not mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament. But even Josephus, in his account of what the temple looked like, he talks about being gleaming white, just like crystal almost from a distance as the sun shines on it. It was plastered with a pure white coating, and everything that wasn't white was gold. From a distance. So that had to be quite a trade, a master craft, perhaps, certainly the Israelis had mastered.
Yeah, and if you can recall some of the stories from the Bible, Jeremiah ends up in a cistern, if you will. That must have been a plastered cistern, and who knows, maybe that particular cistern was something like this one that was found.
Yeah, and again, there's a picture of that over at, I think it's jspace.com, but you can do a search for Israeli cistern, and it'll take you to that that picture. It's quite an impressive thing. I mean, it's 60 feet long, maybe 18 feet deep, I'm guessing, 15 feet wide, and all done underground and plastered smooth. And you've even got electric lights in there.
Yeah, well, maybe.
I suspect they're of recent addition.
Now, probably the biggest site with cisterns, it's not New Old Testament, but it's Second Temple. It's the place called Masada. We've talked about that before, but how many are there, 12 or 14 cisterns that are just huge, and you can understand how important it was to preserve water there.
Well, I think of Jerusalem as a hot, dry, dusty place. Is it?
Not
just short times of the year?
Not in comparison to like Masada, where get only a couple, maybe a couple sprinkles a year. Mm-hmm. Jerusalem, of course, gets more rain than that, but cisterns were indeed used to, contain water, the valuable water, which, of course, was the life source of any culture or civilization.
Well, John, it's been a delight. Thank you for stopping by again. We learned about the old cistern. It goes back to the time of the first temple, 7th, 8th, 9th century B.C., that was just discovered on the western wall, outside the western wall of Jerusalem. And we talked about Hatzor, and we'll look forward to next week. And are there some openings on your November tour yet? Some seats available?
Yeah, we have a couple more weeks. If people want to join us, it'll be a smaller group, making it ideal. But that's certainly something that it's still open and available for anyone who would want to travel with us.
And Jerusalem is on the list?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. That should be just the experience of a lifetime. John Delancey of Glenshaw, Pennsylvania. I'll let you get back to work. I know pastors are busy, aren't they? On Tuesdays, even you don't get a day off, do you?
I just had someone look into my door and wanted to talk to me. So
okay,
that's a good for me to run. So
that's a good signal. John Delancey, thank you very much. And again, you can catch John's recorded conversations with us on the audio archives page at BrokenRoadRadio.com. Music now from Bert Kempfert on a Broken Road Radio Tuesday morning. Good morning, John. Take care. Be blessed.